Okay.
Well, we had an interesting question in Sunday school Sunday morning because one of the translations said Hebrew and the other said Aramaic. Or this evening we're actually going to be in chapter 4, and this is interesting. When we first talked about how the book was put together, we pointed out the fact that chapter 1 was written in Hebrew and chapters 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 were written in Babylonian, Chaldean, whatever you want to call it. They used the same alphabet, so if you were to look it up in a Hebrew Bible, it'd look like Hebrew. I mean, unless you can read Hebrew, it would look like it because they use the same. But it's the language of the Chaldeans. And then in chapters 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, he switched back to Hebrew. And the obvious implication to me is that he was writing the introduction in Hebrew for the sake of the people that would be reading it from his nation, his people. But chapters 2 through 7 were deliberately designed for an audience of Babylonians. And then in chapters 8 through 12, it returns back to a Hebrew audience. And the reason I'm going back over that is that we said that chapters 2 through 7 were written as a chiasm, which just means that there's a repetition of themes. Chapters 2 and 7 are dealing with the same basic issue with a little different twist. And then chapters 3 and 6 are dealing with the same issue with a little different twist. And then chapters 4 and 5 do. But it's interesting that chapters 2, 3, and 4 are all about Nebuchadnezzar. And chapter 5 is about the last night that Belshazzar was king in Babylon. And chapter 6 is in the second or third year of Belshazzar, which is way early because of the issue there. And then in chapter 7, we return to a vision that Daniel actually had, but it's a repeat of the same content of chapter 2. So this evening we're winding up the material on Nebuchadnezzar. And it's kind of significant to me that Daniel thought that writing half of his material to the Babylonians, now remember he wrote it 70 years later, but half of the material was all about Nebuchadnezzar. And then chapters 5, 6, and 7, 5 and 6 are about Belshazzar, but it's his last night as king and then some years earlier. And then the last chapter in the language of the Chaldeans is about a vision that Daniel had. But it's significant because I have often described a chiasm as like climbing a mountain where you're going up and up and up. You're dealing with this and this and this. And then when you reach the peak, you deal with something up there twice and then you go down, down. And the downs are like they're equal here. It's A, B, C, C, B, A. But there's a light side of the mountain, and then there's a dark side. And that's the same thing here. In chapters 2, 3, and 4, God is dealing with a man he intends to save. He's dealing with Nebuchadnezzar, and he's bringing him to humility. And this chapter 4 is actually Nebuchadnezzar's testimony that he was brought to humility and faith. But chapter 5, which is the dark side of chapter 4, is Belshazzar's last night. And you all know that, meaning mean people, you farce, and you've had it. You're dying tonight. And he did. So that's the negative, because Daniel said, hey, you heard all about your granddaddy. You heard all this stuff. And here you are in a drunken orgy taking advantage of the vessels of the house of God out of Jerusalem, drinking your liquor and all that and having all this big party. And he said, I'm here to tell you, you're going to die tonight. You've had it. So there's no mercy there. There's judgment with mercy in chapter 4, judgment without it in chapter 5. So that's our introduction to chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar writes a decree to all of the people that are in the boundaries of his vast empire. And he says, it has seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me. So he starts out with a decree where he wants to share what God did to him with all his empire. And what God did to him was humble him into the dust. So it's kind of an interesting thing that once Nebuchadnezzar did get his head screwed on straight, the first thing he wanted to do was let everybody know that the God of heaven had brought him to understand. And that's relatively typical of people when they come to know God. They get fired up right off, want everybody to hear it. So he just says, I wanted to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me. And then he makes this comment about the impact of the signs and wonders. Because he says, as kind of a prelude, how great are his signs and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. And this is what Nebuchadnezzar had to come to grips with. That's what chapter 3 is all about. Because in chapter 2, he had been told that God had revealed to him the way history was going to run. In chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar threw it in his face. That ain't going to run that way. The kingdom of Babylon is going to exist until the end of time. That's why he built that 90-foot tall polished gold image. But Daniel had told him in chapter 2 that there was a God in heaven that wanted him to know these things. And even in chapter 3, where you run into this problem of the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego not bowing down to this golden image, even at the end of the chapter, Nebuchadnezzar is kind of becoming God's protector. I make a decree that anybody that says anything bad about this God, you know, will just pull his arms and legs off. But the point is, his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom is a direct contradiction to his image that he had set up, that 90-foot tall thing. And I wonder if he did anything about that, really. It doesn't ever tell us. But I wonder after he got his insight, well, he didn't tear that thing down. I don't know. But anyway, the issue is his kingdom, and he calls it an everlasting one, and then his dominion, his rule in his kingdom, is from generation to generation, which implies the same thing that the head and the upper body and the middle section of the body and then the legs, thighs and legs and feet and all. That implies generation to generation to generation to generation. So, he begins his actual tale in verse 4. He said, I was in my house at ease, flourishing in my palace, and I saw a dream. I had a dream and it made me afraid. And these fantasies as I lay on my bed and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. So this is a repeat of chapter 2. He's having nocturnal visions and dreams that are disrupting his sleep and making him afraid. And the very fact that he's afraid indicates that he already has an inkling of what this dream means. He has an inkling. He wouldn't be afraid if he didn't. But it's kind of like the nonsense stuff that we run into as human beings all the time. Because Saul of Tarsus was stopped on the road to Damascus, and this brilliant light brighter than the sun shines all around him. And this voice says, why are you persecuting me? And he says, who are you? Well, who have you been persecuting? I mean, he knew, but he didn't want to know. So there's this, you know. But at any rate, there's an inkling, or he wouldn't be afraid. So, in verse 6, he gives orders to bring into his presence all his wise men of Babylon so that they can make an interpretation known to him. And the magicians and the conjurers and the Chaldeans and the diviners came in. Now, these are the same categories that were there in chapter 2 that he told to do the impossible. In this case, though, it says, I related the dream to them, but they couldn't make its interpretation known to me. Now, that's really interesting, because in chapter 2, he was desperate to know the truth, so he wouldn't tell them. And he said, I know what you're planning, you want me to tell you, and then you'll come up with some cockamamie explanation that's supposed to take the heat off, and, you know. Here, he just tells them what he dreamed. And all of a sudden, they can't tell him. And when you read what he dreamed and what the interpretation was, you can understand why they didn't want to tell him. They had lived with this egomaniac long enough to know that if you didn't keep your mouth shut and your eyes open, you're liable to be dead in the morning. And quite frankly, the vision is so self-evident It didn't take Daniel to interpret it. Even the king, as I said, had an inkling of what this really meant. Maybe not in the details, but they didn't want to tell him because it was obvious what it meant. But we don't know, king, we don't know. So finally Daniel comes in, and I don't know what that finally means, because he had summoned all of the magicians, the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners, and Daniel was the head of that group. He had been promoted over the whole province of Babylon, and he was the head man over all those guys. So when they were summoned, I don't know why he didn't come in, unless speculation. It's interesting how Nebuchadnezzar addresses that, because he says in verse 8, finally Daniel came in before me, whose name is Belteshazzar. Now who gave him that name? He did. But he's calling him Daniel here. I'm not sure what all that signifies, but it does, I think, on the basis of the rest of it, that it indicates that Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar had become acceptable laborers together. Daniel liked the king, and the king liked Daniel. He was sitting in the king's gate. He was the number one guy. And it says, his name is Belteshazzar according to the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and I related the dream to him. Now, I don't think that at the end of the chapter he would call him my God anymore, the name of my God. But at this stage of the game, chapter 2 is still current. He's still in this brainwashing thing. So he told him the dream. And he says, and notice what he says, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, didn't I call you in here? What are you doing in here? He doesn't say that. He says, since I know that a spirit of the holy gods is in you and no mystery baffles you, tell me the visions of my dream, which I've seen along with its interpretation. He doesn't mean tell me what I was dreaming, because in verse 10 he says, now these are the visions in my mind. So however you take that statement, tell me the visions of my dream, I think you have to understand that he was actually asking for the significance of them, because he's going to tell him. In verse 10, he says, this is what I was dreaming. I was looking, and behold, there was a tree in the midst of the earth. Its height was great, and the tree grew large and became strong, and its height reached up to the sky, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Now, you know right now that this huge tree has overtones of a 90-foot tall image that's supposed to be Nebuchadnezzar. So this is why he's uneasy, because this tree's got to have something to do with Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar. And it says in verse 12, its foliage was beautiful, its fruit abundant, and it was food for all, and the beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the sky dwelt in its branches, and all living creatures fed themselves from it. Now, if that isn't as clear a declaration of what a kingdom functions like, I don't know what is. So I'm telling you, he knew. He already had this strong inclination to think that God's talking to him about his kingdom. So the problematical part is that in verse 13, he sees in the visions of his mind an angelic watcher. That's the best way he can describe him, a holy one. He descended from heaven, and he shouted out and spoke as follows, chop down the tree and cut off its branches. Strip off its foliage, scatter its fruit, let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches. If we stop there, this is why he's afraid. Chop down the tree. Uh-oh. But in verse 15 it says, leave the stump with its roots in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze around it in the new grass of the field. And that is probably a way that they used to deal with making sure that you didn't kill the tree when you cut it down. I mean, if it had been like one of these old gum trees, it would have been no problem. I cut one down, a month and a half ago, and it's laying over here, and it's growing green branches out, and the leaves are coming out. It's just laying on a pile of logs. So I didn't have to put a band around. I mean, they'll grow right out of the stump without any help. But in this case, whatever kind of tree this was, I think he knew that putting the band around it was supposed to keep it from being totally destroyed. And it says, immediately in the middle of verse 15, you have this pronominal shift. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beasts and the grass of the earth, and let his mind be changed from that of man, and let a beast's mind be given to him. Now, in the words of the watcher, this tree is identified now as a man. And who could Nebuchadnezzar identify as a man of this stature at this time in history? He's Babylon. You are the head of gold. And then it says, and let seven periods of time pass over him. The seven times thing is going to show up later. But that technically, that's a technical term, and it shows up in the book of the Revelation. We know exactly how long a time is now. I mean, based on not only the latter part of Daniel, but also the book of the Revelation. Because in the book of Revelation, you have time, times, and half a time. And then you have the same period as 42 months. Well, 42 months divided by 3.5 turns out to be 12 months of the year. You have 12 months and 24 months and 36 months and half of that, six more, that's 42. And then the book of Revelation calls it 1260 days twice, 2520 days. Well, 2520 days is twice 42 months, which is 84, which is 7 years. 2520 days, if you go back to the book of Genesis, where Moses identifies the length of the year, it's 360 days. Not 365. They didn't operate on a solar calendar. They operated on a lunar one. And they had 12 months of 30 days each, is 360 days. And in order to make their season to stay in harmony with the months, every once in a while they'd stick another month in. Jimmy the calendar by 30 days, and then, you know, the slop would be in there, but eventually it all worked out and the months would be with the harvest time and all that again. But with 2520 days, that's seven 360 day years. You have 42 months twice, is 84, that's 7 years. And you have time times and half time, which is half of that, which is 3.5 years. So we already know how long the time is. And this time here is seven. So there's going to be 7 years where this is going to be going on. And then you have this pronouncement in verse 17. The sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers. And the decision is a command of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes, and he sets over it the lowliest of men. The King James has the word the basest of men. And base to us implies a moral quality. And the New American Standard decided to move that out of the loop and just put in the lowliest. But it's lowliest in some sense. And so when you get this far, you have to know that Nebuchadnezzar has already got to be thinking that this dream's about him. It's got to be. There isn't any way around it. And this is the dream which I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, tell me its interpretation. Inasmuch as none of the wise men of my kingdom is able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for a spirit of the holy gods is in you. Now, those magicians and conjurers and sorcerers and all, they put on a pretty good show of not understanding what this meant. But like I said, they'd lived with an egomaniac for a long time, and they knew when to keep their mouths shut. At least they should. And so they gave the king the impression that they couldn't understand this any better than he could. But that was exactly the problem. He was already on the verge of understanding it. And they probably saw it for what it was, but didn't want to say it. And Daniel, when he hears it, it says he was appalled. And his thoughts alarmed him. And he didn't want to say anything. The king responded and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, if only the dream applied to those who hate you and its interpretation to your adversaries. If only this wasn't talking about you. The dream that you saw, the tree that you saw, which became large and grew strong, and whose height reached the sky and visible to all the earth, and whose foliage was beautiful and the fruit abundant, which was food for all, under which all the beasts of the field dwelt and all the branches of the birds of the sky lodged. It's you. You have become great and grown strong, and your majesty has become great and reached to the sky, and your dominion to the end of the earth. He didn't tell anything, didn't already know, but he didn't want to acknowledge it. So Daniel just tells him, it's you. In that the king saw an angelic watcher, a holy one, descending from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze around it, in the new grass of the field, and let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beasts of the field until 7 periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king. This is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. For you will be driven away from mankind. Your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field. You will be given grass to eat, like cattle, and be drenched with the dew of heaven, and 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. Now that's the conclusion that Nebuchadnezzar drew at the prelude. Well, this is also the problem of chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar did not want to accept the word of God given in chapter 3. Well, it was given in chapter 2. He did not want to accept the fact that he was only the head of gold, and that after him there would be another kingdom, and after that another one, and after that another one. He didn't want to accept that. That was the word of God concerning human history to Nebuchadnezzar, and he basically said in chapter 3, it is not going to be like that. I refuse to accept that. Well, okay, refuse it, but guess what's going to happen? You are going to be brought to admitting it. It says in verse 25 that this is going to happen until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he pleases or wishes. In that it was commanded to leave the stump with the roots of the tree, your kingdom will be assured to you after you recognize that it is heaven that rules. Therefore, O king, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break away now from your sins by doing righteousness, and from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, in case there might be a prolonging of your prosperity. Now, Daniel's giving him kind of an out. And you say, well, how could he do that? Well, you remember Jonah? He went into the city crying, you got 40 days, ha ha ha. God's going, what? You ought to face the planet. Ah, 40 days and you're dead. And then they repented, so God didn't do it. Well, that's always one of those things about the iffiness of dealing with God, because if he were purely just, you could tell exactly what he would do and that'd be done. But he's not. He's also merciful and gracious, and that opens the door to all kinds of possibilities. When you're dealing with a God of justice, you can decide what he'll do based on what justice requires. But when you're dealing with grace, you ain't got a clue what he's going to do next. Because grace doesn't respond to demands. You can't tell grace, now you got to do this, you got to do that. Because it ain't grace if you got to. And so, you know, there are a lot of people who say, well, if you don't trust God, he's not going to do what you want him to. That's generally true, but it's not always true. There have been any number of times my confidence in God's provision faltered, and he just did it anyway, just to prove that my lack of confidence had no valid basis, and it was designed to strengthen me by embarrassing me for my unbelief. That's a good thing. So what I'm trying to say is, Daniel's advice to the king, verse 27, was rooted in the fact that Daniel knew God well enough to know that if the king would open his heart to the reality that there's a person bigger than him running this universe, and acknowledge the fact that heaven rules, well, then he wouldn't have to go through this experience. I've said this over and over and over to you guys and to lots of others too, but I really believe that the things that happen to us as individuals are personally determined based on what we need to happen to us as individuals. And the reason why some of us face this and not that, and others of us never face this and we face that, is not because this person's more ungodly or that person's more godly or whatever. It's because this person has this kind of situation that it needs to be addressed, and this is the way God's going to address it, and that person doesn't have that need. He has this one, and so God addresses his in a different way. And my evidence for that is John, the gospel writer. He was the only one who went to the cross, and he was the only one that didn't die a martyr's death. He didn't. He had already decided that if it meant dying because he was identified with Jesus at Calvary, then that's where it was going to be, because he was there. So when it came in the outworking of the life, he didn't have to face martyrdom because that wasn't one of his needs. But the Apostle Paul, he was a blasphemer and a persecutor and all that. And so who ended up being accused of blasphemy and persecuted every day of his life? Same guy. Now, he took it well, but there are certain quirks about our personalities that require that God deal with this person this way and that person the other way, and you can't make a rule that says God's going to deal with you according to, because he's not. He's going to deal with us according to our individual neediness and our individual growth patterns and all that kind of thing, because that's what 1 Thessalonians 5:23 is about. God is in the business of getting us ready for our eternal participation in his glory, and he's going to do it individually. So Daniel gives him some good advice. But it says in verse 28 that all this happened to Nebuchadnezzar the king 12 months later. So he had some time to give it some thought. But he'd already established his patterns of luxuriating in his palace or whatever. 12 months later, walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he reflected and said, "Is this not Babylon, which I have built by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty?" He was operating in the full-blown development of his own sinfulness. You know, Hebrews says that, I'm not sure if it's Hebrews, but anyway, we're encouraged by the fact that if we deal with sin when it erupts, it won't set up a pattern of dominion over us. But if we participate in it, we'll find the next opportunity a lot easier, and the third one will be a lot easier than that. And in a little while, we'll be bound in bondage to it, simply because we made these pattern decisions, and this is Nebuchadnezzar's most basic pattern. I did it. That's his default position. It's for me, by my power, for my glory. "And while the word was in his mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, 'Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared, sovereignty has been removed from you, and you will be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field, and you will be given grass to eat like cattle, and 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes.'" Now, you notice this is the third time we run into that. And I asked a doctor one time whether a human being could eat grass like cattle and survive for 7 years. And he said, "Well," he said, "yeah, your body won't handle grass like a cow's body will, but with a little maybe protein supplement and some salt, you'd probably do all right." For, I mean, this was a doctor's, I just asked him because I'd read this. So, I don't know what kind of animal he thought he was. Probably a donkey. But anyway, anyhow, he was pinned up in the field like the cattle, and it lasted for 7 periods of time. "Immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from mankind, began eating grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven. And then it has this little oddity, until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. I asked the doctor about that, too, and he said, well, the grass diet thing would probably cause the fingernails and toenails to be a whole lot coarser and rough, not polished and, you know, like bird claws. And, of course, his hair, if they never groomed him, his hair would be all a tangled long mess in 7 years. And that's probably why that little comment is made, because Daniel knows that the seven times, seven periods of time, is undefined at this point in the prophecy. No, it'll come later. But at this point, seven times is an unspecified period of time. And so he throws in, well, it has to be long enough for his hair to grow like this, and his toenails and fingernails to grow like this. So it's not days, it's not weeks, it's not months. But in verse 34, it says, at the end of that period, now notice, this whole thing is tied up in the timing. At the end of that period, Nebuchadnezzar raised his eyes toward heaven, and his reason returned to him, and he blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. Now, the thing about the end of that period is, we were told that in the last paragraph of 2 Chronicles that God sent the Babylonians in to take Judah captive until they had endured the 70 years of Sabbath rest that they had not allowed the land to have while they were overusing it and not paying attention to the sabbatical requirements. It's interesting that in the book of Daniel, when the prophecy of Jeremiah is given and Daniel runs across it, and he recognizes that Jeremiah said it's going to last 70 years, and he says, how long has it been? And he said, oh, it's almost 70 years. And so the first thing he did was this long prayer of repentance for the whole nation, himself and the whole nation. So the timing thing is real. And the recognition that the timing is there for Daniel meant, because Daniel knew that God was going to lift this captivity on the nation when it repented. And that was going to happen at this 70 year, at the end of this 70 years. But Daniel wanted to make sure that the proper response was given to the God of heaven who had decreed the 70 years. And he went into this long prayer of repentance asking God to forgive. Well, in this case, the prophecy had been that seven times would pass over the king and then the kingdom would be restored to him. But the probability that God was going to restore the kingdom to him without any change of heart on his part was slim to none. I mean, he's going through this process for a good reason, and if it doesn't accomplish that good reason, God's not going to give him back his kingdom. But it was built into the prophecy that it was going to be this way, and that's one of the things Nebuchadnezzar had to come to grips with. When God says something's going to be this way, this is the way it's going to be. And that's the bottom line of his rebellion. And I see that same thing going on in all kinds of people profess to be believers. They read something in the Bible about how God has declared this is what it's going to be, and they say, that ain't going to be that way. And they go through all kinds of heartache and headache and all kinds of other stuff too, including blessing, until they come to grips with the fact that when God says it's going to be some certain way, that this is the way it's going to be. And we need to get that fixed in our head, just like he needed to get it in his head. Because three times in this chapter we're told that until you recognize the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and he bestows it on whomever he wishes, you're stuck. Until you recognize that, you're stuck. And so at the end of the period, Nebuchadnezzar had a divine restoration, but it included him lifting his eyes to heaven and his reason returns to him, and he blesses the Most High and praises and honors him who lives forever. Now, he comes out of 7 years of mental illness, terrible living conditions, and he blesses God for the experience because he learned the lesson that needed to be learned. there is more peace in knowing that God's in control than there is in any other truth in the Scriptures. Romans 8:28 was given to us to give us peace of soul. That God's going to work everything together for our good is the most precious promise there is in the Scripture. But if you start putting limitations on what God's going to do, you lose your peace. You start striving to protect yourself and do all kinds of things, and there goes your life. So until we recognize that this is true, we're gonna have the same kind of negative stuff going on. But he goes on. He says his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth. And no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? At that time my reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor was restored to me for the glory of my kingdom, and my counselors and my nobles began seeking me out. So I was reestablished in my sovereignty, and surpassing greatness was added to me. And so at the end of his personal testimony to all of his empire by decree, he says, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are true, his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. And that verse is one of the reasons that I really believe that the book of Daniel has a moral thesis that is buttressed by the prophetic message. The moral thesis is God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. That James just pulled that down to succinctly to that statement in his letter. But that's the message of this book. God knows how to humble the proud, and he gives grace to the humble. That's Daniel is the humble, and Nebuchadnezzar is the proud. And he recognizes. I firmly believe this is Nebuchadnezzar's personal testimony regarding how God had treated him and what he had concluded from it. And it was a tremendously good thing, but it took a torturous route to get there. Because he had to go through that experience in order to come to that conclusion.